Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon. It's Tuesday. It is a cold and actually a somewhat somber day here in the nation's capital. This is Back in Politics live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in downtown Washington. We got a lot. In a civil tone, and they feel a little numb over today. So we're going to get to the introductions first and get right to work here today. Again, I'm JT Russell. I'm your host, as we are every Tuesday 4 to 6 here on Blog Talk Radio. With every Tuesday, the former officer for the 2nd Congressional District. Burlington Northern Railroad, and now principal with us on this kind of
hey, I'm pleased to be here, but it's not the kind of day that there's anywhere else to be.
Yeah. With me as always, also on Tuesdays, is former minority committee. He is the former floor chief for Gerald R. He's the former vice president of affairs for National Broadcasting Corporation, also a principal with Colleen Swift and Hines. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Justin. It's a sad day.
It is. Joining us from Hawaii, I believe, on the air with us. Also, and no Ralph. There's no Ralph, but that's okay. Ralph, can you hear us? We'll try to hear you. He's our executive director of the First Congress Society. He's a former White House liaison staff to the Department of Homeland Security. He is currently pursuing his master's degree at University. He's the executive director of First Congress and our executive producer here on First Congress. It's Perry Blasstein. Perry, thanks for joining us. Tuesdays is here's on. For those of you who have been here in the nation's capital, obviously going on, watching the news, on Saturday, this a tragedy happened in the northwest. Attempt, and that is the only way that we can put this, was by a young, obviously deranged human being against who I feel is one of the great compromisers in Congress, and that's Gabrielle Giffords out of Arizona. The congresswoman was still in critical condition, was shot in the head. Also caught in the crossfire, who was also the judge in the district, the uncle who himself had been the target.
Just as much disagreement on policy, but there was not nearly as much acrimony, there was not nearly as much lack of civility, if you will, that we see today. Members knew each other better. That helped bring trust. They were able to negotiate better than they can now because there was trust. That's lacking now more than it used to be, and that's a failure of the institution. And it's unless that is fixed, situations like this, terrible as they are, probably are not going to change people's mindsets unless they can decide that they're willing to talk and meet and know each other, negotiate with each other, trust each other. When that happens, there'll be less harsh rhetoric, at least on Capitol Hill. There's an awful lot of harsh rhetoric other places, but at least on Capitol Hill, the rhetoric would be a little more civil, members would get along better, and we would have fewer problems.
I want to talk about going back to the civil discourse that we're experiencing today. We've said many times on this show in particular that this is the worst that we've seen. This is obviously the worst I've seen in my lifetime. I've heard people who have been involved in politics say that this is the worst that they've seen since 68. This reminds them a lot of 68 and the violence of the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the assassination of Martin Luther King, and the assassination of Malcolm X in that time frame.
The shooting of George Wallace.
You know, the riots outside the Democratic. This is the time of discourse since we've seen in 68 in over 40 years. This is before my time, but you all both were directly involved in the political environment back in 68. Does this, in fact, remind you of that time? How does it differ? How bad is it in your view of being around Washington and in the rest of the country? How bad is it right now?
Well, stepping back a little bit from just Washington, the biggest change between 1968 and today, in my opinion, are the cable news channels, which do not even attempt to be to present all sides of an issue, are to be try to be fair-minded. We have channels that are seriously supportive of the programs and the attitudes and the interests of the left side of the country, if you will. There are channels that are on the right side of the issues, not right. And neither one of them ever, neither the channels just no longer, the guys and gals who are on the channels are not attempting to have a rational discussion. What they're attempting to do is proselytize. What they're attempting to do is to reinforce already fixed opinions.
I remember when John Kennedy was shot. We were watching CBS. And I, like a lot of young liberals, noticed that there was a lot of right-wing activity going on in Texas. And my reaction was, God damn it, the right-wingers killed the president. And after I expressed that, Rick Severide came on the scene. No conservative heat. He was a liberal commentator, and he said, do not jump to the conclusion that I had just jumped to. He said, there is no evidence that it was that. And as it turned out, it was if anything, a left-winger, but he was really just a nut. It wasn't the right wing at all. And it was a commentator like Eric Severide, who was himself a liberal, who was the one pointing it out. It's hard-pressed to see that happening on cable news.
You see it on cable news, on any of the news channels. And I can understand, they're looking for an audience. Numbers are important. That seems to be driving their news focus.
Do you have a comment?
Well, the purpose of this society is just that, to bring civility back in. Take out all the innuendo, the bickering, the nagging, it gets away from the central core of the problem. Is, yes, we're going to have idiots like this out here doing things like this. It doesn't mean that we just throw our hat up. It means that we've
is, in my opinion, and we're going to talk about this panel, fighting is not important. We need to bring the discussion to the table. Perry, you had a comment.
Well, Justin, you had a question how bad is. One of the issues that's come out of this in the last few hours is the new speaker, Boehner, has sent a letter to the White House letting President Obama know that he's at least scheduled the State of the Union for a few weeks from now, for January 25th. And in that letter, one of the things that he said is that in light of these recent events, we're simply being reminded of the imperfect nature of our representative democracy, that just because there's many states and nations that look up to us, and just because, you know, we can have a bloodless transfer of power, doesn't mean that we're perfect, and it doesn't mean that situations like this won't affect us. However, he went on to say that we cherish the ideal that our government exists to serve the people, just like our representative in Arizona was doing when this unfortunate incident happened. And while we're reminded of how imperfect we are in light of this tragedy, we have to move on. We have to continue. This dialogue certainly is one of the things that's going to help us do that.
On the phone with us, Ralph, are you on the phone with us?
Yes, you've been fading in and out, but now I've got a clear connection.
Ralph, you've been around the political scene for many years here in Washington. What are your thoughts about what the current political situation here is in Washington, and what's the feeling that you're getting out? I mean, you've been in Hawaii, you saw the events roll down, you know, five time zones away. What's your view? What are your feelings on this?
Well, my concern is how this is going to impact the ability of people to be able to interact with their members of Congress when they need to come to D.C. or to meet with them in their districts to discuss legitimate issues. There's talk of increasing the security for the members, which is a good thing, but how is that going to impact the ability of their constituents to have the face-to-face and personal interaction that is sort of a hallmark of our democracy?
Well,
the other issue that has been raised is the issue of guns and whether gun control laws would have prevented this individual from being able to be licensed to carry a weapon and because of his mental condition.
Ralph, tell me, going back to the original point of this first segment of why – the First Congress Society was created and why we do this thing of ours. You're a board member of the First Congress Society, as am I, as
right.
is Bob and Al. What drives you to be part of this thing of ours?
Well, it's so important to have civil discourse and be able to interact with people that have different points of view and to be able to listen effectively with an open mind. You're not necessarily going to agree with the other person's point of view, but you're going to discuss their viewpoint civilly, and you're going to respect what they have to say and come together to reach a common consensus. And that's what our founding fathers envisioned. They didn't envision this rhetoric, this kind of backstabbing, these kind of violent outbursts among people who are angry that something isn't going their way. I mean, it's about bringing people together and compromise and working on issues for the benefit of the American people.
We're gonna continue this discussion without a break. I mean, this is still breaking news as we speak. So we're gonna forego the break right now, probably until the top of the hour or close to it. But I want to go back to the discussion of what happened in Tucson. Again, for those of you who are just joining us, we're talking about the events that have unfolded over the past 4 days following the tragic events in Tucson, Arizona. Right now we have an upstanding member of Congress, one of my favorite Democrats, Gabrielle Giffords, now still in critical condition. I personally have a personal fondness for her only because of the fact she's an advocate for the space program. She has crossed party lines to truly space. For those of you who know, I'm Washington from Brevard County, the home of the Kennedy Space Center. The Kennedy Space Center of that area. She fought tooth and nail with the local governments, the local officials down there, to keep a robust and strong space program going. She's married to an astronaut. He is slated to be the next mission commander on the next shuttle mission, which is supposed to launch in April. That obviously is now going to be a subject of discussion, but regardless, what's equally her brother-in-law is the commander of the International Space Station, and that Earth of ours, now knowing what can I do, she truly is a Congress who truly was a pillar of what we talk about, compromise. You know, civil discussion on political issues and thing. The other tragedy includes the law of the judge, federal judge John Wall, who himself has been part of media political rhetoric and violence in some instances. He was just going to visit his in this town hall and just want to stop by and say hi, show his support. The other tragic story, along with the loss of Congresswoman Giffords' instructor, who lost his life, a young gentleman who literally just came to the Hill. The other tragic story is a little girl was there, a neighbor who was there just to part of the political. Many other people in this exchange. We've heard a lot about accessibility of all kinds of solutions. They're talking about take back a little. This is a risk we take.
It's a kick. One thing Congress does very, very well. And I think that we've got two members of Congress that are very unprecedented. That's an overreaction. I think to surround members of Congress with additional security because of this event, which we hope and history would suggest is going to be a singular event. We're not going to start shooting at various members of Congress. Should that trend start, then you'd have to seriously look at security. We had in my offices, I was in a lot of vets coming out of Vietnam, thoroughly screwed up. Some very scary. They were and in their and they were seriously harmed in terms of their mental balance. Many of them were lovely and just kind of nutty. Some were pretty scary. We finally did put a phone line directly between my office and the Everett Police Department, so it was a block away. Because I had only women in that office, and there wasn't a guy there to even attend. But we never, ever had a lot more evidence of need for something else.
But you were on the private sector. Did you ever feel interacting with the constituency? And I would also ask your interpretation of your member, former President Gerald Ford. Did President Ford ever feel that this is something that could be a possibility? Obviously, back to Steve Frome and the instances in California where there were several attempts on his life. But as a member of Congress, did he ever see that being a possibility in interacting with ones in their home?
As far as I remember, I think most people are concerned about being with their constituents. I think there are overreactions about security. It strikes me that one suggestion I heard yesterday was that it would be, and I gather this was done by the police chief on Capitol Hill, he suggested that it would be wise for members when they're going to be in public, out in the public, it would be well to have a police officer just let the local police know that they're going to be at the supermarket or at the county fair or whatever, so an officer can be there. Just the physical appearance of the officer apparently would be useful as far as the secret police was concerned.
And
I think
would,
that makes sense.
And I would agree that rather than saying the whole federal security thing that following 535 members of Congress around, that the local police are perfectly capable. I remember Senator Jackson was a huge proponent of the Vietnam War, visiting the college campus in my hometown, which was a hotbed of opposition to the Vietnam War. And the Bellingham police, about 6-7, just kind of showed up. Now, I don't think they thought there was going to be an attempt on his life. I think they were there to see that the kids didn't get too boisterous or too loud or something like that. They were discreet about it, but the security and it didn't cause any.
As a former member of law enforcement yourself, you experience the question of having a police officer, just one police officer there. Completely surrounded by plexiglass, if they be paranoid, I'm saying be just waltz across there. Saying be more aware of your surroundings. Behind. Whatever reason, it saved her because the round entered through the back of her head and the upper part of her lobe, her brain, and exited with it. It allowed the brain to not swell up as in cases when you have a fracture in the brain. Back to the question, we can't just put ourselves in a little bubble and walk around. We need to get out there. The people need to see, but mindful of the idiots that are out there, the crazies that are out there.
And we're going to talk about that here in a second. Ralph, in your
You're cutting in and out. I'm still on the line.
Ralph.
Hello.
Ralph.
Yes, you're cutting in and out, but I'm still on the line. Go ahead.
In your...
Hello?
Yeah. We'll continue.
Okay.
Ralph?
Yes, you've been cutting in and out. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, Ralph. Stand by. We'll come back to you here in a second.
Okay, I can hear you now. It's perfect.
Hold on a second.
Okay.
I'll take a little bit of a break and play some music and get a little bit. This is back room on a somber Tuesday afternoon in Washington, D.C. We're live on Blog Talk. We'll be back in.
And we're back here at Shelley's Back Room in downtown Washington, D.C., here at Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room. It's the bottom of the hour, actually 20 till the top of the hour. And with us on every Tuesday, as they are always, is Al Spitzbehinds, Barry Blasting. Frank the Body stepped away from the studio for a second. But and joining us out in Hawaii is Ralph Winnie. Again, for those of you guys just joining us, we're talking about the events that happened in Tucson. There's many subjects around this. But one of the subjects that is the issue of the political rhetoric. It's funny to me that, you know, we as a group have sat here, and I want to just interject one thing. We are not doing, you know, we're not, I'm not saying this in order to be politically biased. I'm saying this to promote, because this is the core thought that many people in this country have. The subject has come up about the political, and did the political rhetoric drive this individual with the motivation of a complete stable and brain? We've even seen the some members hone in on the fact they aren't bringing out the political rhetoric, even as we really a visual. For one, you're looking at the gospel and follow through, even in a violent situation. There's a rhetoric.
Well, there would be enough good, and those media who government. It's a very dicey situation. Can you tell Red Beck, I call him Red Beck, that he can't find the That's a real First Amendment.
It ever has been before. Even worse. Technical difficulties. Bob, going back to your original point, finish that thought, because that's an important thought here.
I've seen it before we had technical problems. The newer media, the cable media, were a little more out there with their news reporting. media, which has always been more on a more balanced type of program, and by this more balanced and if you will, you know, defend ourselves. Much.
Yeah.
And the one newscaster said, "Oh, okay. Do you have any proof of what you're saying?" "Well, no. It's just my opinion." What? I understand he's up for re-election, but what? That's as bad as the news media throwing their two cents in.
Well,
bias.
I would have to disagree that what he said was out of line. It was certainly his opinion. He was in a position. And he said something that a lot of Americans agreed with.
Right.
I don't think it was a misuse of his office, if that's what you're suggesting.
No. The Harvey McCowney I had mentioned with is long, long-standing member of the law enforcement community in Arizona. The man is well into his 70s and has been reelected wholeheartedly by the constituency in Pima County. Like this, he has said in his years of law, seen anything like this. But going back to the all, how do you forward from here? Do you honestly think they are the problem or the solution? Rachel Howe and Goldman continue on their Rachel Howe said truly disturbed me that the state is not the right is incorrect. I think that personally is an irresponsible comment. That being the case, I pose the question again. How does the media move forward?
I don't know that you can check the a lot of parts are making by being provocative, intentionally provocative. Those on the right are defending themselves. Those on the left, both are committed to the audience. And I just think in serving the public rather than the we would have known about already. I wouldn't expect any of them to change.
Bob, I agree. That being said, we're coming up on the top of the hour. It's 9 minutes before the top of the hour. We're going to take a short break and continue our discussion. When we come back, I want to talk about the political rhetoric that's surrounding the gun rights situation. The anti-gun rights community has come out in full blast. I also want to talk issue with Sarah Palin, which has gotten a lot of attention. So stay with us. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room here in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. Stay with us. Thank you. It's 5 here every Tuesday. Bob Hines, Rob, and joining us always is Frank Bodyguard. Welcome back to Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom here in Washington, D.C. We'll pick up where we left off and talk. We're continuing to talk and discuss the situation surrounding the tragic Tucson, Arizona, where Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords' life and six others who were involved in the shooting lost their lives at a town being by the common in town. Included in the deceased is the Honorable John Wall, Chief of the Arizona Judicial District Judge, who was on the bench for a while, a longstanding member of the Federal Judiciary, and all the victims and all their families in this tragic time. Going back, we were talking, one of the issues that is coming up is the continued continued hostile subject that we should put up. That I've seen is the example of the former of Alaska, Sarah Palin, who has on
came out right after people bring that up. Commentaries, situation, they weren't supposed to be, bulletin or anything like that. Asked about it when this was originally challenged itself, they're meant to be bullseyes. So if you can get into the semantics of the difference between a crosshair and a sure, mostly speaking, they were crosshair.
Well, right down to
earlier, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, using the same tactics on a and they were similar targets, if you will. But yeah, it can give that one clue of put a target. I've got to follow my
political rhetoric and in politics in general. The rhetoric into postings on the web of this mainstreaming. I don't know if mentioning individual and we're back, backroom politics, live from Shelley's back room in Washington, D.C. Want to, Perry, just in the interest of full fact checks, we want to clear up the comment Frank you had made, but we just want to fact check it. Perry, what did you find?
So essentially, one of the arguments being made right now, especially by supporters of Sarah Palin, is that Democrats also use the tactic of crosshairs on a map. Specifically, what they're pointing to is a Democratic Leadership Council map that was put out after the 2004 election that did have crosshairs on the map. Now, the difference between these two is Sarah Palin's map referenced specific members of Congress with the crosshairs over their districts. The Democratic Leadership Council map was referencing targeted swing states with the maps, or with, excuse me, crosshairs over the states that needed to be more strongly targeted in the 2008.
And one could argue that a state or a district does not matter. It's still the same. I think it's inappropriate, especially after the events in Tucson. I venture to say that a lot of the political pundits will think twice about using quote unquote crosshairs in their political propaganda.
Did that with that in mind,
but well, regardless, I think it's arguable. But one of the things I want to go back to now that we're back at the top of the hour, for those of you joining us, Al Swift, Bob Hines, Perry Blasstein, Frank the Bodyguard is here. I'm your host, JT Russell. The issue of the individual, the individual himself was obviously deranged, and you were discussing earlier the fact that this was the act of one individual as opposed to a political conspiracy, if you will. I do know that the New York Times had reported that this may have been part of a larger conspiracy. Now, whether that's true or not, I mean, we have to take at face value the word of the New York Times. That being said, this individual, Bob, we were talking about, I claim that this was obviously a targeted assassination. And your comment to that is?
Well, I agree. I think apparently he went there intending to shoot her, from what I have read.
Right.
Now, the questions for us as we're talking here is, was it a political act or the act of just a loony who, for some reason, was aggravated about her? I gather we were off air for a moment during the break, we were talking here, apparently at some previous meeting that she had had, he had also attended, and he had asked a question which he felt she didn't answer, and he was offended by that, apparently.
Right. And well, I mean, it's come out in the investigation, and again, I want to be clear. The position of the First Congress Society, because of our orientation, this individual is innocent until proven guilty. However, the facts of the investigation can allow us to make an intelligent and unbearing focus and make a statement like this. Obviously, he went in 2007 to a similar town hall event with the congresswoman and said, you know, asked the question. He did not answer it, or the congressman did not answer it in a manner that was appropriate for him, and that just set the snowball in motion to what has happened here over the past 4 days.
May have.
That's correct, Al. That being the case, we're now hearing gun rights issues being brought up as part of the political discussion surrounding this event. Number one, regardless of the events, the gun debate is going to continue on for as long as there's a Second Amendment, no question. The question I have, though, is, one, is it an appropriate discussion right now, or is this something that we should allow to just you know, take its natural course in civil debate. Al?
Well, it inevitably will be brought up under these circumstances. It always will. It is when some crazy student goes and shoots a bunch of teachers and other students. It never seems to move the debate any direction. The NRA immediately rises to defend itself and guns in general, and those who are opposed to guns make their points, and I don't think anything moves.
And I think that I would be extremely surprised if anything moves in the Congress. I think both sides will argue their case. There'll be no new arguments. We have all heard them for years, and then we'll hear them again.
But is this an appropriate discussion for this time, or?
If it's not appropriate now, when would it be appropriate?
It may not be appropriate for the next week or two, if that's what you mean. I mean, you know, if we're talking about the immediate follow-up, at least until such time as the mourning period is over, et cetera. I think people ought to hold their fire no matter what. It's just a matter of good taste. But it will come up. It has to come up. And it will just disappear.
Now,
quite frankly, we got too many really important things that we can solve or can work on the Congress ought to be working on, trying to fight the gun battles over again when the Congress is going to do nothing is just a waste of time and energy.
I want to ask a question around the table, and I only do this just so we have perspective. It was a question that was asked of the candidates for chair of the National Republican Committee. And it struck me as being an odd question, but now in light of our discussion, Bob, do you currently own a gun or have you ever owned a gun?
I've really never owned a gun.
Al?
I have never owned a gun.
Perry?
Never.
Frank?
Many.
Okay.
I also, Al and I have spoken many times that just because you have a gun and you have a permit to carry it, doesn't mean that you are able to display it, threaten, or use it.
Right.
But
hold that thought. Ralph, do you own a gun?
I don't own a gun, no.
Okay. I just want to put it in perspective. I personally do not own a gun, and I'm former law enforcement. I choose not to. Number one, it's illegal as a resident of the District of Columbia to have a handgun in my residence. But offset, even when I could, living in Florida, living in Georgia, living in Wisconsin, it is never something that I had. I chose not to. When I turned in my shield and my service piece, I turned in my desire to own a weapon. That being said, let's go back to the discussion. I just wanted to get that out there. I think it's viable that everybody know where we stand.
That's
fair. So when we talk about the gun discussion, whether it's appropriate or not, like you said, Bob, it's going to back up. Does this give charge to the anti-gun community? Does this give fodder to the NRA to say if people had carried guns? It perhaps prevented this? You were going to make a comment.
Because it is a member of Congress, you know, a member of the Congress. The reality is, nothing is going to happen in this Congress, period. Nothing will happen. The votes aren't going to be there. That doesn't mean it won't be argued. That doesn't mean it won't be very hotly argued, but it's not going to happen.
Al?
I totally agree. It confuses me as to why this is the one issue in which the slippery slope argument seems to win the day. The slippery slope argument is that if you register a gun, the next thing is that the government's going to come and take away your gun, and so therefore we mustn't do anything. The NRA is opposed to doing anything, and it's all based on the slippery slope argument. Now, we register our cars. I suppose the government come take away all our cars. Well, that's absurd. The idea that the government would come and take away everybody's gun is absurd. It has to be about yes for guns or no for guns, rather than can take away society and protects the right of gun owners. I think it can be done, but the NRA absolutely
that moved up to take this gentleman, this idiot down, had a concealed weapons permit, had taken the safety off, had his hand in his pocket of what he stated. This was stated to the news people. And he approached the gentleman that had picked up the weapon, the Glock, and told him to drop it. So the guy that got the gun away from him put the gun down, and they asked him, would you have used it? He goes, no. I'm glad I didn't shoot him, because that would have opened up a whole other can of worms. Like I said earlier, having a gun, having a permit, doesn't give you the right to threaten someone or use it.
Right.
And I agree.
Perry, you had a comment.
So the gentleman who had the concealed weapon, the argument, of course, that he made is he could have prevented this. Well, he was just around the corner at a different store for the shots, ran towards the shots. There's no reason. One is that he took his coat pocket. The reason he did that, he said, is he didn't want to be justified.
Right.
So this brings a whole other argument of even if shots were fired, somebody pulls a weapon, if law enforcement's there, how do they know that's just a concerned citizen with a carry permit?
And you know, the funny thing about it is Arizona, I mean, arguably, along with being a bastion of political rhetoric going on, whether it's immigration, whether it's gun rights, whatever. I mean, Arizona's gun rights laws are tremendously liberal. They allow open carry. They have very liberal concealed carry laws. One example I have is while down in Tucson, and this kind of hits me a little bit personally, is while I used to travel extensively to Tucson for business and used to stay in a hotel very close. This is an area that's close to another town called Oro Valley. And the shopping center I used to frequent a lot, just get sodas and go into the Safeway in particular. So I know the area. While in Tucson and going between Tucson and another town in Arizona, Sierra Vista, in between those two towns is the town of Tombstone, Arizona. Went to Tombstone, Arizona. We went, took care of business. The locals in Sierra Vista, we told them we were going to go to Tombstone. We wanted to see what it was like. One of the locals there actually told me, he says, when you get to Tucson, be careful. Or when you get to Tombstone, be careful. I said, why? He said, you're going to see people in Western dress, boots, spurs, cowboy hat, cowboy blouses, and you're going to see people walking around on the street with Colt 45 revolvers strapped to their hip, like the old Wild West. I said, oh, that's kind of cool, kind of period actors. He goes, those are not actors. Those are the actual residents of Tombstone. You drive into Tombstone, you don't have a police department, you have a marshal. And they truly believe it is their right to carry open a Colt 45 into wherever. You can carry a concealed weapon into a bar, not only in Arizona, but in Virginia. So that calls into question, and now you can't drink when you do this, but it's still, that defies logic to me. But Arizona is obviously an area that has very liberal gun laws, and this is going to be the focus, not only at the federal level, this is going to have to be because Congresswoman Giffords was, in fact, a member of the Arizona legislature before she came here to Washington. So that's got to – how do we fix this?
It's pretty hard. It's pretty hard to fix it when you're talking about the culture, because that's what you're talking about here. Arizona is that way. New Mexico is that way. Texas is that way. Oklahoma, I suspect, is that way. So you're talking about a major part of the country. Where the even visible on your hip is not a bad thing. You've got a right to do it. And in the dark city, someplace else, out in the West where it's part of their culture, they have learned to live with that. I don't know if that'd be comfortable.
Now, look, you've got some thoughts on this.
Well, I do not understand the enormous emotional attachment that many gun owners, many, not all, many gun owners attach to their guns. I remember being in a bar once, listening to a guy who was a little pitchy to the wind, but he was sitting there saying, when the Ruskies, I'm taking my guns up into the hills and going to defend America. And I foolishly said, I didn't know you could bring down an ICBM with a 30-06. And I thought he was going to hit me. He was outraged because what I had done is I had really attacked his manhood and his patriotism and his sense that he was going to be a heroic defender of the nation. But the fact is, I'm right. 30-06s aren't going to be much good in a nuclear war. So I simply don't understand what gun owners are so terribly afraid of. One of the arguments is if people don't have guns, then only criminals will have guns. Well, who's talking about taking guns away from all the people? No one in their right mind are saying that.
Bob, go ahead.
Al was talking about an example of one man. But what are these militias of except people who go around, we'll be ready to defend America if we need be. There are militias in many of the Midwestern states. In my own state of Ohio, there are four or five different groups of militias. And they practice, small arms practice. They go out in the woods and practice, different kinds of maneuvers.
Well,
and
if they really wanted to carry out that role, then they need to start buying tanks. They need to have an air force.
Yeah.
They need to have missile systems that they can.
Yeah.
That's how the war would be.
The idea is rather foolish. I mean, if somebody actually they had to defend the country, the people they'd be fighting against would have a hell of a lot more weapons than they do.
Frank, problem when you mention the word militia is that denotes you got the white supremacists that have their own self-described militias that go out and practice, and they along with training with the guns, they teach hate, bigotry, the superiority of the white race. So what do you do with those? Law-abiding citizens, but preaching hate and killing people because you're not of the same quote-unquote white race. So when you use militia, again, it's a slippery slope. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Well, you've got different militias with different kinds
correct.
Of...
Correct, correct. Correct, correct. You know...
Justin, I'd like to just interject here.
Yeah.
My understanding was one of the ways they were able to bring down some of these militias was the fact that they had not legally registered their firearms.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a tactic used by law enforcement in investigating some of these organizations is, how many of these firearms are legally registered, which also brings up the issue of this individual that, this individual is obviously not of a stable mind.
Well, then the next question is, he purchased this gun legally. He went through the correct requirements.
Right.
But obviously he has a lot of psychological issues. Are we going to start requiring people to undergo some sort of psychological evaluation when they want to purchase a gun?
Well, that's been a question that's been brought up in the recent days after this event, is the fact that this individual did legally purchase this weapon. The individual did it in accordance with Arizona law. And quite frankly, this is an individual that displayed questionable mental stability. He was in a community college in Pima County that several of his classmates questioned his stability and actually feared for their life. And one of the people in the classroom was the professor, the teacher, the instructor. If he displayed those types of tendencies, does he legally have the right, or should, as some people have called out, like Ralph said,
should we start looking at mental stability checks, invoking maybe possibly a Baker Act situation? Al?
Well, one of the things that has been proposed in the past is having a waiting period. Now, my understanding is this guy bought the Glock days, a very short time before he did it. There was no time to check that out. Certainly, his record, a period, I'm not talking months, I'm talking shorter time than that, they would have found out about the mental instability and that he would not have got the gun.
Wasn't he also turned down when he tried to
military.
Get into the military?
Correct. Because of drugs?
Yeah.
And he had had a couple run-ins with the law. So his rantings, if you read any of his statements, total rantings, not making any sense, repetitive, just a real loon.
Right.
Really out there.
Well, this discussion is going to come back and forth. It's not anything we're going to solve here, obviously, but it's...
All of the arguments we have just made have been made time and time and time
again. And will continue to be made. Yes. I absolutely agree with you, Al.
We'll hear them all on the floor of the House and Senate the next month. That's the teacher.
I agree. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom here in Washington, D.C. It's the bottom of the hour. We're going to shift... excuse me. We're going to shift a little bit. And I want to talk about the reaction of Congress here in our last half hour. I got to tell you something. My personal opinion. We know that the president is traveling out to Tucson tomorrow. The administration acted very swiftly in this event. In fact, I don't even think the president had finished his statement before the director of the FBI was wheels up on a jet out of Reagan heading towards Tucson. There's no question that an entire task force is in place. The last time a situation like this where a federal judge or a federal employee of high-ranking stature was targeted, there were 250, 300 FBI agents in play working with local, state, and other federal agencies on this investigation. But what really got me and what I want to bring up for discussion is the reaction of both Speaker Boehner and Minority Leader Pelosi in this. Speaker Boehner was the first to come out in calling this obviously what it was, a heinous event. Speaker Boehner condemned this event, but there seems to be a coming together in both sides of the House and both sides of the aisle in the Senate, uniform in their discussion of this has to change. Why does it take this, number one, to have to change the way that business is done in Washington? Al?
And I have always tended to poo-poo the enormous amount of young race. But their real strength is their membership. And those people who will come to you in your district and scare the daylights out of you. Tom Foley tells a story of having a meeting, public meeting, and a guy walked in with what they call them bandoleros, you know, bullets that crisscross, you know, and his rifle, and he walked to the front of the room to Mr. Foley and laid his rifle down on the table and said, "If you try to take away that gun, I'll get you." you take notice of things like that. And so I think it is the fear of the individual of those members of the NRA who are over the top in terms of their affection for their guns, not all members of the NRA. I had a very good friend who was a member of the NRA, and he was a hunter, and that's all his interest was. But some members of the NRA just like the guy that was going to go into the hills and protect America, who are irrational about, irrationally paranoid about protecting their guns. And those are the ones that scare the living daylights out of you as a member of Congress when they come to you and practically grab you by the throat and say, don't take my gun away.
Bob, let me ask you the question. Why does it take an event like this to have to bring civil debate up to the forefront? We haven't heard this in years, thus the creation of the First Congress Society. Why does it take an event like this to have to bring everybody to, quote-unquote, come together?
Let us hope that it does bring some a little caution to the statements on the floor and the statements other placed by members. I suppose it's just that we don't expect things like this to happen, and we get inured to saying something. I say something a little bit, over the line, and you say something back to me a little bit more, and over months and years even, we get to the point where we're not sensitized anymore to some of the things we're doing and saying. And I think that is probably what that means is that, when you have a situation like this, everybody suddenly says, oh my God. And if they're any kind of a reasonably sensible person, they probably think a little bit about, have I done anything at all that moves us in that direction? And that is the only good thing that can possibly come out of this, is it makes people step back a little bit and say, I've got to be a little more civil.
Ralph, in your discussion, in your discussions or in your interaction with the government, is this coming together sustainable?
Well, I think in the past, there haven't been consequences for people that have crossed the line. I think now, for the first time, everyone is really shaken by what's happened to Gabrielle Giffords. I will throw this out. When Governor Lingle, candidate Lingle, was running for governor, she received a lot of hate mail, emails about her race, her religion, and what she did was she referred all of this to the Justice Department. So they were on record that she was that these attacks were being made against her, and that allowed for extra police protection when she went out campaigning at different rallies. My understanding is that Gabrielle Giffords' office had been vandalized, that there had been threats against her life, but for some reason it did not trigger any additional police protection, any security or belief that her life was in danger. And if they had taken these threats seriously, I don't think this gunman would have been able to have attacked her the way he did.
Perry, you had a comment?
No.
Okay.
I can make a comment.
I have a comment if I haven't forgotten it.
Yeah.
And I have forgotten it.
Okay. one of the things, we're going to see a lot of legislation coming out in this, and one of the pieces of legislation that everybody is coming together around, or some of the suggested legislation that everybody's coming together around, is we mentioned it before, is Chairman King's proposal of not being allowed to have a firearm within 1,000 feet of an elected member of Congress.
Well, it's actually that some of his spokesmen have said that they're still working on the substance of the bill. But what it is right now, the idea is within 1,000 feet of high-level government officials. Now, that clearly would need to be defined.
Right.
But I guess for now, at least, it isn't any member of Congress. And, King is chairman of the Homeland Security Committee.
Right.
And he's co-chairman of the Congressional Task Force on Illegal Guns. He's got some power with this. I certainly don't know, and we can ask our former congressman where this legislation is going.
Al, go ahead.
I remembered. Isn't it interesting that when a congressperson is shot, it takes on so much more importance than when you mow down a classroom of children? Has no political implications whatsoever. Many, many, many more people have been killed by crazy people who were common folks. They were not officials. They weren't prominent in any way. And those things, we get those, what, four, five, six times a year. But when a congresswoman gets it, then that automatically and understandably raises the level. But shouldn't there be some concern about the general fact that people get killed all the time by crazy people who, for whatever their reason, that they've been bullied, that was one. And so their solution is go kill athletes and people. Why don't we get as excited about that?
Go ahead, Frank.
We had mentioned earlier about the reason for what's going to happen with this. Al, when you were in Congress, the last thing I'm sure that went through your mind as you were leaving your office is, I wonder if there's some wacko out there going to shoot me. Okay? It boggles my mind that we have to have something like this for us to shake the tree and see what happens.
Well, I think that's Al's point. I agree with that point.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, people are gunned down in this country every day, but it takes a blatant attack on, you know, taking the life of a federal judge and the attempted assassination of a seated member of Congress to kind of bring this back to the foresight. But I go back to the original question, is there's a lot of harmony. There's a lot of civil debate going on, even if it's about the gun rules, even if it's about how we conduct business in the legislative bodies of Washington. We're hearing a lot of coming together. We need to be one in this. We've got to stop, tone down the rhetoric. Speaker Boehner himself has said that the rhetoric has got to slow down. We've heard Harry Reid echo very similar. The two questions I have regarding that is, one, is this harmony sustainable? It seems that Congress has a very short, short memory when it comes to situations like this. And number two, in this coming together, that if this all back, this is the
question. Well, the second question remains to be seen whether this is just the other issue. And when you asked it, I thought you were asking whether you thought this would lead to gun legislation, and I said no. But now I hear your question, will this lead to a lowering of the rhetoric in Congress? And that, I think, can happen and will happen, and in part will happen because of John Boehner, because of the way he reacted to it, and the way that I think he demonstrated a responsible way to continue to be pro-gun. But say we got to lower the volume of the rhetoric in general for the benefit of the Congress and making decent decisions. That I think might happen.
Bob,
I think Al makes a good point. I would only remind us that within the next 60 and 90 days, we're going to have such divisive votes as the how are we going to go about raising the debt ceiling. We're going to have to pass a budget resolution. We're going to be with all kinds of efforts to cut one thing or another the Republicans want to do.
We're going to try to repeal the health care bill.
Health care bill.
Well, that actually brings up a very strong topic. Is the health care bill repeal legislation was not just repeal the health care bill. It was introduced in the hopper as the repeal of the job-killing Obamacare health care bill.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that needs to stop. But the question is, when you get down to these issues that are very important to the members of the Congress, will they be able to pull back from their usual somewhat demagogic statements on the floor on both sides. You know, this, you know, world is going to come to an end if this happens or doesn't happen. If they can, if they can pull back a little bit, we have a chance maybe to be able to maybe not change any votes, which I don't think is really nearly as important as having a Congress where at least people start being civil to each other more than they have been in the past. And maybe long term we'll have a better place in the Congress.
You know, one of the things that I noticed in the media coverage in the media coverage here was the tone of, we've all said that one of the issues with Congress today and part of the problem that we have is we do not have members of Congress who get to know each other. Yet, in this discussion after the tragic events in Tucson, we've seen everybody coming together saying, I knew Congresswoman Giffords. I knew her, worked with her. Even the president came out and said, I was close and worked with her. So does this lead to maybe a situation where we will see more members of Congress getting together and getting to know each other? Al?
Do you know, I was busy lighting a cigar while you were asking.
which we are often able to do here at Shelley's.
Would you just repeat the question?
We've heard a lot of people talk about, you know, well, we've talked about it on several radio shows in the past, about part of the problem of the current situation here in Washington is that members of Congress don't get to know each other.
Yes.
Yet, in the media coverage, we've seen several members of Congress come out saying, I know Congresswoman Giffords well. I believe she is one of the great, great representatives in the House. I worked with her very closely. Does this mean that we're going to see, I mean, does this just invoke members of Congress to do what we've been advocating, is get to know the other people you work with?
I don't know whether it will lead to getting to know each other better, because you've got to do a couple of other things before that's going to happen. And this may contribute to getting rid of some of that other stuff. The idea that you can't walk across the aisle and sit down with a member of the other party without being criticized by your party for consorting with the enemy. That kind of crap may be reduced, and that will lead ultimately to people getting to know each other better. Once you get to know somebody, if you like them, you know, sometimes getting to know some members of your own party, it convinces you they're not very nice people.
Right.
But getting to know some people on the other side, and you find, for example, I grew to be extremely fond of Henry Hyde. Henry Hyde and I agreed on one thing.
And Congressman Hyde, the ranking congressman from
Illinois,
right,
at the time, and he led the fight to impeach Bill Clinton, which I didn't support. And he, when I first came to Congress, his was the name that was anti-abortion.
Right.
And my wife and I are strongly pro-choice. He had horns,
right.
Huge horns. But I remember taking my wife onto an elevator, and there stood this tall, rotund, white-haired man who was so incredibly gracious to my wife, and she got up and the elevator, and she said, "What a nice man." And I said, "That was Henry Hyde. You're devil. You're the person that you've been cursing for years, you know." And the fact is that he continued to be pro-life, and we continue to be pro-choice, and he and I continue to disagree on almost everything. But I grew to respect him and like him, and any debate that we might have had, we weren't on the same committee, so we didn't have debates one-on-one, but it would have been so much more civil because I respected him and I liked him.
There's a lot of other news stories. We haven't had a chance over the past 2 hours to talk about it. This is obviously consuming much of the news cycles and will continue to do so in the days ahead. I mean, there are several other issues. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on which side of the aisle you were on, a news story broke actually not soon after on Monday. Former Speaker of the House, Tom DeLay, was sentenced to 3 years in prison as a result of his money laundering conviction. We'll talk about that more than likely next week. You know, the repeal, the actions of the Republican-led Congress to repeal the health care bill is another issue that was being brought up to the forefront.
And that was so important to the Republicans, and John Boehner put it off. I think another sensible and sensitive action on the part of the new speaker.
Al, did you find that the old cliche, you keep your friends close and your enemies closer when you were in Congress?
No, I never worked that way.
I think
there's great merit to that, and Machiavelli would have certainly admired it. But my approach was, let's not make enemies of people that don't need to be enemies, particularly on the other side of the aisle. So it wasn't so much of keeping my enemies close as it was to make my opponents friends where I could.
So this concept of the round table, should it be let them hear it again, the premise of what our founding fathers meant to do. What we're doing here, bring civility back. You don't think someone should go in there and say, hey, take a look. It's grassroots, but take a look. It's working.
Well,
I want to take
a couple of minutes here real quick. I very rarely pontificate. This is a subject.
You what?
not on the air. I tend to moderate more than I comment. But this subject, you know, struck me particularly hard, and that's why I've been commenting more than moderating on a lot of the subjects we talked about surrounding Tucson. But I want to make this statement, and it's a little bit soapbox. It's a little bit marketing. I don't want to come across that way. I want to say one thing. Subjects that we talked about today, political civility, getting to know those members of Congress, getting to know who you are, the toning down of this is something that Congress society has been advocating long before their first Congress. It is something that
long before anyone else,
long before everybody else jumped on, we were broadcasting this exact subject. This is an opportunity now for those who either listen to us or may listen to us in the future. I urge them, I implore them, get involved. Know what's going on in your local community. Know what's going on in your state delegation. Know what's going on here in Washington that might directly affect you. Become educated in the current stream of politics as it stands today.
So you can know what you're talking about.
Exactly. It is organizations. Now, whether it's our organization, First Congress Society, whether it's you as an individual just taking an individual approach to this, I urge everybody to get involved and become active in the way that they are not only governed, but take a vested interest in those who govern with you.
Well said.
It is something that the First Congress Society will continue to advocate. It is something that we will continue to bring to the forefront of political debate. And I personally, I can't speak for the rest of the board members or other members of the First Congress Society, but I personally will make it a personal issue to ensure that we hold those standards to those elected officials at the lowest local level, to the White House here in Washington. It is now more than ever. We have to come together as a nation. United we stand, divided we fall. That's my soapbox. I don't know if anybody wants to add on to that.
I would only add that the foundation, that the start of First Congress Society was because most of the people sitting around this table used to sit in around this table or one like it, and we would have different points of view and we would discuss them and we would disagree. And it wasn't always Republicans versus Democrats. I can recall Bob and you, both Republicans, having disagreements on issues. And we never got mad at each other. We each learned a little bit because of the different perspectives that were brought. And one day we sat there and said, we were talking about how contentious Congress is. And we said, why can't they be more like us? Why can't they sit down and discuss things and exchange points of view and at the end of the day depart friends? Why can't that happen? And we said, well, can we do anything about it? And that's how the First Congress Society was founded.
Ralph, you want to add anything to that?
No, I agree with everything that you said. I think civility is so important, and being respectful to someone that has an opposing point of view is very, very important. You do learn from listening with an open mind to other points of view. People that are very rude and obstructionist, that are very have tunnel vision, are not going to grow and develop, and they're not going to be able to effectively represent their constituents. The key is to reach out and to work with both sides.
Right. Well said. I want to take a couple of minutes real quick. We talked about all the victims, those who lost their lives. I just want to just mention the names of those who lost their lives, those who were in attendance at the town hall meeting, those who arguably, whether they agreed or disagreed with the congresswoman, were there to be part of the solution, not part of the rhetoric problem. The deceased included, obviously we talked about the Honorable John Rawl, 63, Dorothy Murray, 76, Dorwin Stoddard, 75, Christina Green, 9, and you know, in an ironic turn of events, Christina Green is also the granddaughter of Philadelphia Phillies general manager Dallas Green. We also lost Phyllis Scheck, 79, and the Congresswoman's Communications Director, Gabriel Zimmerman, 30. Our thoughts and prayers go out to their families. Our thoughts and prayers and wishes for speedy recovery go out to Congresswoman Giffords and her family. We wish them Godspeed for a swift and total recovery. We wish speedy recovery to all of those who were injured as a result of the Sanus Act. We will return next week, hopefully on more lighter tone, lighter issues on all things political. We appreciate your participation. We appreciate you listening. Live from Shelley's Back Room, this is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay, we talk about the heroes of the town. I'm sorry to end. I don't know. I mean, there is...